Blog Talk Radio.
Well, bend down the hatches. It's Thursday. It's the Throwdown, and this is the show that starts at 5:30 Eastern in Pittsburgh, 2:30 drive time. Coming home from downtown in Los Angeles, the Doc Talk podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, Dr. Greg Roscoe, in Pittsburgh. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, not sitting in traffic in Los Angeles, but manning it from the studios. 347-205-9631. This show goes quicker than Dan Rather doing 60 minutes. Catch archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast. Platforms wherever you subscribe to the podcast, powered now by Mancini Media. So as they lay the groundwork down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, Doc, the threes. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? Nice to be back after that crash last week with AT&T customers and everything. And now you got a great guest coming in. I'll man the boards till I see you at the top of the hour.
Wow. Mark, thank you for that good introduction. And, you know, I want to thank our listeners for bearing with us last Thursday night, you know, with the AT&T crash. Boy, that doesn't happen very often, but indeed it was a problem. So thank you for bearing with us and coming back to us. People can get a hold of me, as they have, gjrmd308@outlook.com. You know, we have a great guest tonight. She is a friend of the show. It's Dr. Libby Smith. She's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She has a big title. She's director of the Voice Center for the University of Pittsburgh, with many other titles. She deals with difficult swallowing problems as well as vocal problems. Libby, good evening. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me back.
Nope, it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure to have you on last time as well. And again, thank you for sharing your evening. I know your family is very important to you. Thank you for giving us this hour. You know, Libby, with regard to what I've been getting emails about, something that kind of struck me a little bit was a listener had emailed me with regard to the larynx about, you know, tuberculosis of the larynx. And it's something, of course, I've never seen, and I know maybe you've seen very complicated cases, but have you seen any tuberculosis of the larynx in your career, Libby?
No, it's really interesting. I've been doing this for 18 and a half years. I've had one case of tuberculosis of the larynx.
Wow.
It was many, many years ago, but that's exceptionally uncommon to see it in the larynx. Mm-hmm.
And Libby, you know, as far as that whole thing, we don't see the tuberculosis virtually none anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, we don't see that much of it, especially in if you're in a less densely populated area.
Sure.
So I know that my colleagues in New York, they're going to see it more than I'm going to see it here in Pittsburgh, you know, those who work in New York City, let's say. So,
sure.
Yeah, we don't see that much of it. The patient who I had came in with hoarseness because that's what I take care of. And when we looked at her voice box, I saw these irregularities on her vocal folds. Thought that's not right. And so we ended up taking her to surgery and biopsying it and found out it was tuberculosis. So she didn't have any pulmonary or cough symptoms, which was kind of interesting. So, yeah.
Wow. So in a sense, you have to be prepared all the time for some of the unusual things.
It does happen sometimes.
And, you know, Libby, just another unusual one, kind of we probably don't see very much. What about syphilis of the larynx? Is that, again, something very, very rare and very unusual and not of today, you know, today's medicine?
Right. So I've never seen it. I think that there's going to be other symptoms that patients are going to be having that will lead them to be treated. And the medical treatment, from my understanding, is very effective. And
sure.
So, you know, we don't see it in the larynx. I'm sure it's happened, but I've never seen it.
I don't see it. Yeah, I mean, you know, I get a lot of emails, Libby, and some of the questions, you know, like that are kind of interesting things you don't really think about because this day and age, we don't see those kind of things.
Right. And as an ENT, I don't see it either. So, we don't see it in the larynx. Yeah.
Right. Thank God. And, you know, Libby, as far as this evening, you know, just to review with our listeners, you know, the anatomy of the vocal cords and things. And, you know, one topic that I do see a little bit of course, is hoarseness. And you and I both realize the severity of hoarseness, but also something called vocal cord dysfunction. When the vocal cords aren't moving properly and they're causing some breathing issues, but also maybe mimicking asthma, something along those lines. Do you want to expand a little bit about the anatomy of the voice box and where it sits? And what if the vocal cords aren't working well?
All right. So, I think it's great to set the foundation of where the voice box is and kind of how it works. So it sits in the middle of your neck. For men, if you feel your Adam's apple and go south just a little bit, you're in this hard cartilage. It's housed in there. For women, we don't have prominent Adam's apples, so we feel the cartilage that's below where the vocal folds sit. For us, we feel there, and then go north a little bit, probably about a centimeter or so. So the vocal folds are basically paired structures. They sit like a V in your neck. So there's a right one and a left one, and they open from the middle to the side. So when you are breathing in, they're open. That's the whole plan, so that you can get air down into your windpipe or your trachea down to your lungs. And then when you talk, you use that air that you just breathed in, and your vocal folds close, and then the air going through those closed vocal folds ends up making the sound. And so they open and close in conjunction with your breathing or your talking or singing. And so vocal cord dysfunction is kind of a large term, and it's a tough term because everyone has – a lot of people use slightly different terms but mean the same thing. So vocal cord dysfunction, paradoxical vocal fold motion, exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, irritable larynx, there's a whole slew of titles for it. And every specialty kind of tends to lean towards a different title. So it sometimes makes it hard for us to communicate. But in general, these folks come in and they have some sense of difficulty breathing. Classically, it's on breathing in or inhalation. Sometimes, though, it can be on breathing out, and sometimes it can be on both breathing in and out. Sometimes they can have a high-pitched noise, which we call stridor. It's like a whistle noise when they're breathing.
Yeah.
And what that indicates is that the vocal folds might be closing when they're supposed to stay open. And so instead of staying open when they're breathing, they're closing, and it's hard to breathe because the door is closed. Maybe not all the way, but it's closed enough that it feels not right. And then it's hard to breathe. And then people oftentimes will get very nervous because it's scary to not be able to breathe.
Absolutely.
And then that's a normal protective mechanism that our bodies have. And so when we see these folks, we will obviously get a history, and that really guides what we think is happening. That's the most important part of it. And then we basically confirm with looking at their voice box, and we do that by numbing up their nose and putting a little scope through their nose. It's like a big piece of spaghetti, and it's got a little camera at the end. We feed it through the nose, and it looks down at the voice box from a bird's eye view, and we basically test them. We say, okay, breathe in and breathe out and say E, and we're checking the motion of those vocal folds to make sure that they're opening and closing as they're supposed to. And then we're also looking for, is there an obstruction, a blockage anywhere that we can see, right? So at the level of the vocal folds, right below. But you mentioned that oftentimes these people are misdiagnosed as asthma.
Right.
Which is true, because breathing problems are sometimes hard to, like, figure out, right? And so I think the number is about 30% of people with asthma also have whatever we want to call this, VCD. And so there's a lot of people have both, and that makes it tough. But the people who have had asthma for a while and then develop this, they can tell the difference. Like, this isn't the same as my asthma attacks. And
sure.
when they try the inhalers help sometimes, but not fully. Whereas with an asthma attack, you'd expect it to get rid of the symptoms or significantly
Surely.
Improve them. And so it's actually sometimes just the act of doing the inhaler, not the inhalant itself, that's improving them, forcing their vocal folds open. So we basically treat them with a behavioral therapy called respiratory retraining therapy to teach them how to keep their vocal folds open when they have this predilection to want to close. And it's usually very successful. So it's very
wow.
cool. So then they can go out and do the activities they want to do. That's the whole goal. We want you to be able to do what you want to do, whether it, in
sure.
this case it's activities, running, going up and down stairs, whatever it may be. Now, sometimes folks will have also anxiety about it, and that makes it worse because it's scary to not be able to breathe. So we talk about that also, and a lot of it is understanding and giving the people who have this power back over their voice box so that they're in charge of their vocal
wow.
folds, not their vocal folds being in charge of them. So it's really scary
wow.
for patients, and I'm glad that, you know, there's the knowledge about VCD or whatever term you want to call
sure.
it is becoming much more known across the world, where like 10 years ago, no one knew about this, or very few people knew about it. And
sure.
and now more and more do. So we get a lot of referrals from pulmonologists, lung doctors, because they're like, it's not just the asthma, there's something else, which is great because then we can help these folks.
Boy, that's beautiful. And, you know, again, I think, you know, Libby, we've talked in the past about the four pillars that we use in medicine. And I think you alluded to two of them to start with. Number one is that history, listening to the patient's history about what's happening. And then, of course, number two is actually looking at those vocal cords. So you're looking and watching those cords move. And, Libby, you know, as far as this whole thing with watching these cords moving either regularly or irregularly, do they vibrate differently, or does the vibration of the vocal cords have nothing to do with this vocal cord dysfunction?
Yeah, it's really the latter. It's a really good question. So when we're going to back up just a tad. When we make sound,
sure.
not only do our vocal folds need to come together, but what happens when you do that is it generates a wave or a vibration that travels along the vocal fold, and that's what makes the sound. So I left out that little part. So
okay.
that's the vibration is more for phonation when you're making sounds. For breathing, there's no contact of the vocal fold,
sure.
so there's no vibration.
Got it. And, you know, you mentioned the word stridor. With
yeah.
regard to, you know, the physiology of stridor. But I think, Libby, along with that, which I just had an email here, and the listener likes to know, what about coughing? What is coughing all about? How does that affect the vocal cords? Or do the vocal cords affect the coughing?
Oh, that is a million-dollar question. So cough, that's a tough one. That's
mm-hmm.
a whole thing right in and of itself. So in a nutshell, cough can be caused by a myriad of different things. Anything from your medicine, lisinopril is
sure.
kind of famous for giving a throat clear that sometimes generates into a cough. It can also be from being dehydrated, not drinking enough water, where your spit is just too thick and you're clearing it, and then that generates into a cough. It can be because you have a lung issue. You can be from asthma or something
sure.
else in your lungs. It can also be from reflux, right?
Wow.
So having
yeah.
acid either coming up your esophagus, traveling the wrong way from your stomach up your swallowing tube, and irritating the nerves in the esophagus that also innervate the voice box. So you get a referred sensation,
yeah.
and that leads to cough. It can be from sinonasal issues, allergies, sinus congestion, that type of stuff. So there are a ton of different things.
That's
and
everything.
So it's everything.
That's everything.
So, you know, taking care of someone with cough is actually usually really hard, because oftentimes cough is caused not by just one thing. Every so often it is, but oftentimes it's it's several things. And so you have to be really methodical and go through the list based upon their history. You may focus a little bit more on one section, and then you literally treat stuff and check them off the list, right? But you always have to keep
got
that
it.
List running, and then do there.
Sure.
So usually the vocal folds themselves are not the source of the cough. They're really the end organ that ends up doing
okay.
the cough, right? They're the ones that are slamming
yep.
together to cough, but they're not usually the instigators. They're really the innocent bystanders who are just along for the ride. So if you do cough a lot, you can get injury to the vocal folds. It can bruise
yeah.
them. It can cause
wow.
irritation. But that usually is from a lot of coughing. And very,
sure.
very uncommonly, if you cough hard enough, there's these little blood vessels in your vocal fold, and they can, like, burst, right? They can
burst,
just
sure.
kind of bleed a little bit. Again, that probably happens more often than we know, and it's kind of no harm, no foul. But every so often, you know, people grow a little non-cancer bump on their vocal folds, and really their only instigating factor was they had a cold with a cough, and then they were hoarse afterwards. And so, again, that history kind of helps drive – you know, where
sure.
we go with it. But cough is tough. So your listeners,
cough is tough.
Right on. It's a great
yes.
question and a really complex one.
And this area is very sensitive to that, correct? Making those symptoms. So it is something for their professional to be pretty darn smart how to attack that problem. So,
yeah.
very good question. Very good question. You know, I have... And another interesting question, what about choking? How is choking affected here, or how do the vocal folds affect choking? Is there a correlation with dysfunction of our vocal cords and the choking aspect people have, you know, when they're trying to drink or trying to eat or they're swallowing their saliva? You know, how do you see that as well, Libby? You know, with regard to, quote, that choking sensation.
Yeah, so that's another great question. And so when we talk to folks who are having choking issues, the first thing I always ask them is to describe what they're talking about without saying the word choking, because that means different things to different people. And so medically, when we think of choking, we think of food going down
yes.
past your vocal folds and blocking your airway, where you can't breathe and you need the Heimlich maneuver. That's very uncommon. But I think
okay.
most of these folks, when they say that, that's not what they're meaning. I think they're usually meaning, oh, they cough a little bit, or it feels like it gets stuck, but it's still going down. So it
mm-hmm.
can mean a bunch of different things. So that's the first thing. And that will kind of help me get a better idea of
got
what's
you.
Going
yes.
on. The other thing is it with liquids or solids or both? So when someone has an issue swallowing solids, and let's say a typical scenario would be I had a sandwich and I took a bite, or whenever I eat a sandwich and I take a bite, you know, I feel like it gets stuck and I have to use water
yes.
to wash it down. That's a
yes.
not uncommon thing. That usually indicates an issue with the esophagus, the swallowing tube. And so
mm-hmm.
because of the questions, it guides us, okay, what test do we need to get now to see what the source of the problem is? You know, are you avoiding certain things eating-wise because they're too hard to eat? They always get stuck. What do you do when it gets stuck, right? Do you have to cough it back out, or are you able to wash
sure.
it down with some liquid, right? So that type of thing. Now, the vocal folds don't have a huge amount to do with that. Usually in those cases, the vocal folds move fine. But kind of segueing
okay.
back to the vocal cord dysfunction, some people will say, oh, well, if your vocal fold isn't moving, you have one that doesn't move, it's paralyzed, let's say, it can't close the door to the airway, which is one
mm-hmm.
of the stages when we swallow. There's a whole bunch of things that happen, and one of the most important ones, last things that happens, is your vocal folds close to protect your windpipe. That's a defense mechanism for your body, because that's bad. You don't want
sure.
that to happen. That's called aspiration, and that can lead to needing the Heimlich, or in the case of liquids, you can, if you get enough stuff down there, you can get pneumonia. So if they say,
wow.
yes, I cough whenever I drink liquids, I'm really keyed into how are their vocal folds moving. And I also, they're talking, so I'm listening to the quality of their voice. And if they're really breathy, again,
sure.
I'm going to be very concerned that they don't have, like, full motion of both vocals.
Closure.
They don't have closure.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take a peek and verify that and see what the situation is. And so, again, it's an amazing question because it covers so many different things. So we try to figure out, like, what substances are the issues and,
sure.
you know, how severe it is. Have you had pneumonia, et cetera?
So it's a matter of getting a very good history about what's
Absolutely.
Going on, which, you
yes.
know, you do. And it seems this part of the body has a lot going on, a lot of innervation, and can give us a lot of different symptoms. You know, Libby, with regard to, you know, we talked about swallowing. Do you want to comment on the three phases of swallowing? You know, how our food gets there from our mouth down into the esophagus?
Yeah, sure, no problem. So there's three or four stages, depending upon who you talk to. So the first stage
sure.
is the anticipatory phase, where you think about it. So let's say you've got a big mouth-watering sandwich sitting right in front of you, right? And I just said that, and
yes.
so probably a lot of people, I don't know, my mouth started to water, and I started to think about
yes.
how amazing is it going to be to eat that sandwich, right?
Sure.
And so you process in your head, you've eaten sandwiches before, you know what it means, you pull up like a little file folder of how to eat that sandwich,
okay.
muscle-wise. And so this is really important because if you have, let's say, dementia and you've lost the ability to realize what it is in front of you and you may think it's a sandwich but it's an onion or something like
Ooh.
That, probably a more
sure.
common one would be an apple. You think it's an apple
wow.
but it's actually an onion. Because it's round,
Got it.
Right? And you take
right,
a
right, right.
big bite of an onion, that's going to be a shock,
Ugh.
Right? And so it's an anticipatory phase, right? We know that our swallow is a little bit different when we swallow liquids and solids. It's the same general mechanism, but the strength of the swallow is going to be more with eating a sandwich versus drinking a glass
sure.
of water. Right? And even
Correct.
Think about it. If you drink water versus coffee or something hot, that swallow is a little bit
Ooh.
Different too, right? So
yes.
we have all these different swallows that we've created a file for, is the way I kind of think of it, like a little file cabinet in our brain that you've created over your lifetime so that anytime you see object A, you know, pull up file folder for object A, and then that's the one we're going to use. So that's the anticipatory
okay.
phase. The next one is the oral phase, and that's where we put whatever it is that we're eating or drinking in our mouth, and if it's food, we chew it up really good. And then we create what's called a bolus, like a little package of the munched up food, and then we push
yeah.
it to the back of our mouth, and then that's the end of the oral phase. And then when we actually shoot it down, that's called the pharyngeal phase. And our tongue is actually the key to that because it's got to be able to push that food or liquid to the back of our mouth, and then that triggers the next phase of the swallow.
Phase, yes.
During that phase, your vocal folds closed, as we mentioned, and your voice box also goes up a little bit. And it basically tucks underneath your tongue to protect your airway so that when you swallow, whatever it is that you're swallowing, is going to have an easier track to get to the swallowing tube, which is just on the back side of the voice box. So you tuck the voice box
yeah.
underneath the tongue, and then the esophagus is sitting right there, right? And then it goes down
yes.
for the next phase, which is the esophageal phase. And that we have no control over. Everything else we do, but that one we don't have control over.
And so there we go with regard to anticipatory phase. I think it's a great one. So I think maybe our listeners weren't aware of that, you know, overall
a lot of,
thinking about.
Right. A lot of people take that one for granted
yeah.
because we don't think of it, but we've already swallowed the object in our head most likely before we actually do it. And I always think of, you know, when you have babies, this is foreign to them. They don't know what pudding you're giving them or applesauce. And so they're still creating. It's called a patterned motor response. And it's held in our brainstem in a really old, like a part of our brain that's really sturdy, and it basically, they're creating those files, those pattern motor responses.
So we're starting that very early in life.
Yep. Right. I mean, we would never give a baby a sandwich, right?
No.
One, they don't have teeth, so that would be tough. But they also haven't created enough swallowing history in themselves to know what to do with it, right? So
we
start with, you know, milk, and then move on to, you know, applesauce, rice, like stuff like that, like minced rice,
sure,
like that's thick. Right, a puree, because that's they have to figure out how to work that, right? We've all, if you feed a baby the first time, they don't usually know what to do with it, and it usually comes right back out. And with time, they figure it out, right? So they're creating those files.
Interesting discussion. You know, with regard to, say, a consistency, you know, I think you had mentioned that water, it gives us a different signal than that sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So that overall, when we have that foul, our brain is telling these voluntary and involuntary muscles what to do, correct?
Yeah, it kind of gives us an idea of, even though all the muscles are going to be used in their own orchestra of events, you'll kind of, it'll let your body know, well, how hard do I need to push for this? And how careful do I need to be in packaging this bolus up in the back of my mouth?
Sure.
So if you think of, let's take the sandwich again, you create that bolus, that package of food. It's all mushed up, and it stays pretty together, right? So that's very different than if you have liquid. There's nothing holding it together. So you've got to be really quick with the liquids. They're actually harder to swallow for some people because they're too fast, and they get away from them. And so it'll sneak down into their windpipe before they even know what's going on. And so we see that sometimes in stroke. We see that with vocal fold paralysis. And, you know, and then you know that that's the problem, so then you work towards a treatment to help them with that.
You know, I think you're absolutely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, you mentioned two other things, Libby, and I wanted to get to the studio. This half hour is gone very quickly. But, you know, you mentioned the word stroke. And, indeed, if one has a stroke that's affecting the tongue or the vocal fold area, these people will have a myriad of swallowing difficulties, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So strokes can happen anywhere in the brain, and so depending upon where they are, it then affects whatever organ would be attached to that, right? So the tongue would be one of them. Those people would also have what we call dysarthria, where their voice is very not articulate. It's kind of I can't think of the word. Just not disarticulate. And also there's other locations that will lead to vocal fold paralysis. So we know about those. And sometimes if you have a brainstem stroke and it's a really not a good one, you can actually lose all those file folders that you've been creating over time. And so those folks actually just don't know how to swallow. So they need to be retaught how to swallow again because they've lost all those files. So the location of stroke really matters and will affect, you know, how severe or not severe your symptoms are.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, again, going to the fact that this area of our body is highly innervated, multiple sets of muscles are working, and the coordination is so important as well for everything to work consistently, to have us swallow, but also to speak. Libby, I'd like to go to the studio in L.A. if you don't mind taking a few questions.
Absolutely.
Mr. Mancini in L.A., can you help us?
Yeah, I got quite a few. I'll throw three of them and get it back to you in this great interview as we hit the top of the hour in Pittsburgh and in Los Angeles. Newcomer to the show, Daryl, listening from Lake Havasu, says, where does laryngitis fit in all of this? And sometimes he'll get a tickling sensation in his throat. What's the cause of that? Great question.
Oh, it's an amazing question. So I'll take the second one first. So a tickle sensation is really hard to know exactly. Sometimes it can be from just not drinking enough water, being dehydrated. Sometimes medicines will dry us out and it'll give that tickle. Sometimes reflux. You know, it's a matter of if that's persistent, that's something you want to talk to your primary care doctor about. And they may or may not send you on to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. For laryngitis, that is usually viral, meaning not bacterial, so you usually don't need medicines for it. You don't need antibiotics, usually. And it oftentimes is a swelling of the vocal folds. And what that does is that makes them so they don't vibrate well. They're too stiff. And so you can't make nice, easy sound. And, they're just really swollen. And really the treatment for that is don't talk because it's not going to sound good anyways is what I always say. And you're at a slightly higher risk of causing injury, usually not long term, but it might just take you a little bit longer to heal up. And then sometimes like if I'm taking care of someone and their voice, they absolutely need it because they're a professional singer or something like that and they get laryngitis. Or you're a teacher or whatever you use your voice for, and if you need it kind of sooner, sometimes we'll give steroids for that to just try to help the swelling or the edema to come down. You know, I know that in Pittsburgh this winter we had horrible laryngitis, and I had it. I had no voice for three weeks, nothing.
Oh, my God.
It was ironic considering what I do. And in the end, it's a matter of you just have to wait it out. I had to wait 3 weeks to get my voice back. Now, on a side note.
And you have children as well.
I do. I got it from one of them. They didn't get laryngitis, though, which was fascinating. And then, but what's always good to know is that if you don't have a cold and your voice goes bad and you're like, oh, I just have laryngitis, right? We all say that. That there's kind of a rule of thumb because we want to make sure nothing bad's going on. So my rule of thumb is if you're over the age of 40 and you've been hoarse for like 2 to 4 weeks and you don't have like a reason for it, you need to get checked out because you want to make sure you don't have a cancer or something that could be making you hoarse. Right. And so in those cases, we always make sure that we take a look at the voice box, the vocal cords, and make sure that everything looks good. Right. And then we can give you a reason why are you hoarse and hopefully assure people that it's not due to a cancer. Yeah.
And, you know, along those same lines, Libby, that rule of thumb would probably apply to a smoker, even a non-smoker, correct?
I would say everybody. I mean, if you're a smoker, the risk is higher. So maybe go on the 2 week level. But if you think about it, I was hoarse for 3 weeks, right? And so I'm a non-smoker. I'm over the age of 40. And I had the luxury as I got to look at my own vocal cords and I could see if they were swollen and there was nothing else going on. So I knew it was just straight up regular laryngitis. But that's, you know, something that I can do because this is where I am. But, you know, if for your listeners, if you have prolonged hoarseness, you need to get that checked out for sure.
And, Libby, you know what? You used the word reflux, and I know we know what that means. Would you mind maybe talking about reflux a wee little bit for our listeners, just in case there's no misunderstanding of that word?
Yeah, sure. So the most common definition of reflux is when I'm sure everyone has had heartburn at some time, right? Like you eat some really awesome Italian food with all the tomato sauces, which just tastes so wonderful. And then afterwards you get heartburn. You feel that kind of burning in your chest. You can also have indigestion, just doesn't feel quite right. You can have like bloating, that type of thing. So that's classic reflux. Every so often, people will actually regurgitate, not necessarily the food, but feel like acids up in their mouth, right? So that's acid reflux. And that's basically where your stomach makes acid, and that breaks down the food that you've just eaten. That's part of breaking down the food. You need to have that. There's a valve called the lower esophageal sphincter at the bottom of the esophagus, right where it connects to the stomach. And it's like a door. And so what happens is that door is usually closed, except for when you swallow, it opens to allow the stuff to go into the stomach and it closes back up. So some people have, I'm sure you've heard of a hiatal hernia.
Yes.
That's where there's some of the stomach is kind of moved up, and so that door doesn't work as well anymore. And so there's an increased chance of having reflux in those folks because the door isn't as good. The sphincter doesn't work as well.
Mm-hmm. It's a leaky door.
A leaky door, right. So if that happens, the stuff, whatever it is that was in your stomach, can go back up your esophagus the wrong way. It's going the wrong way down a one-way street. Now,
wow. In
babies, it's not uncommon for that, we call it refluxate, to go all the way up to the back of their throat, maybe even to the back of their nose. So when they're laying down, it can go up. And we think that sometimes causes ear infections and stuff. And I'm not a pediatrician, so I can't speak too much to it. But we know that that happens. In adults, I think that that's far less common. One,
sure,
everything's longer. It's got to travel a lot further. But you can also have the nerves that innervate the esophagus. It's called the vagus nerve. It has a whole bunch of different branches. And a bunch of those branches also go to the voice box, which makes sense because it's sitting right next to it. And so sometimes people will feel like, oh, I've got a tickle in my throat, like the other caller was asking about. And sometimes that can be due to reflux. So we will work a lot. We always think about acid reflux. There's also something called non-acid reflux. But our first thing that we usually try is make sure that any sort of dietary and lifestyle modifications, trying to avoid acidic foods, fatty foods, spicy foods, don't eat within 3 hours of laying down, don't have really, really tight clothes, like you need to be comfortable. So if you do those things, that oftentimes helps a lot with the symptoms.
Sure.
And in general, the American diet is very good at making reflux, just based upon what we eat. Like hamburger, french fries, love them. But if you have a predisposition to having reflux, that may not be the best thing for you to have. And so we do have medications to decrease the amount of acid that your stomach makes. But I always tell folks that I'd much rather prefer you do this in a healthy manner, like eat better foods, Mediterranean diet, that type of thing.
Sure.
Don't eat right before you go to bed. And oftentimes that helps more than anything else, right? And you didn't have to take a medicine, right? So I say the medicines are there. If you're going to go have Italian food tonight and a really nice glass of wine, have your medicine there with you, you know, that type of thing. So that's totally fine. Yeah, exactly. And then you have a better idea of what it is.
You know, Libby, along those same lines, we can get back to Mark. You know, even if someone does experience reflux or that indigestion, sometimes eating smaller meals may be a little bit wiser than having, two or three large meals a day, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not just what you eat. It's how much of it you eat. You can overload the system, basically.
Beautiful.
And,
very good. And, I think we're not off subject. I think we're talking about, the GERD, our laryngitis, our vocal cord dysfunction, hoarseness, things like that. Mr. Mancini, you have more questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me tell you two more and let you get back to the great interview with about 22 minutes left in the show. Albert from Poway says, listening to the show, great work as always, Dr. Greg Roscoe, with your great guest. What are the signs of damaged vocal cords? Wow, that's interesting.
It's a really good question because that's what we always want to try to make sure it doesn't happen. So probably the most common thing is you get hoarse because it maybe damages the vocal folds. And that then causes hoarseness.
And, if we use the word damage, sometimes we can talk about little scars on our vocal cords, correct? A nodule, those kind of things, Libby. Would you look at that as damage of a vocal cord?
Mm-hmm. So we can see a couple different things. So we can see non-cancer bumps on the vocal folds, there's a whole bunch of things. There's nodules. Those are like calluses. You can get polyps, which are not like colon polyps. That's always everyone's first questions. And nodules on the vocal folds are not equivalent to thyroid nodules. So you can have little cysts. You can have scar. That's usually a longer effect from whatever injury is occurring. But usually it's from what we call traumatic phonotrauma, basically slamming the vocal folds together too hard too many times. So I've got a great fact for you. So how many times, I won't quiz you, but if we think about
ahead.
How many times do the vocal folds contact each other in that vibration that we were talking about in men? The answer is about 100 times a second. So
wow,
I'll just let that sit for a second. That's pretty crazy, right? And then in women, we have higher pitch voices, so the frequency of that is higher. It's about 200 times a second. And then if you're a professional soprano singer, they can go up to this thing called high C, they call it, and it's over 1,000 times a second. I mean, it's mind-blowing.
Tremendous.
Wow. So you've got this area of the body that's contacting each other hundreds of times a second, and it's sensible that if you overuse it and misuse it, you're going to be hoarse, right? So I'm in Steeler Nation here, and on Monday, the number of people calling in who have probably been yelling at the TV or were at the game yelling, they call in and they're like, I'm hoarse. And it's like, yeah, it's because you were yelling for 3 hours yesterday, right? So, you know, that's normal. I mean, you don't want that to happen, but that's what the voice does if you overuse it and misuse it for a long period of time. Now, usually that, like, recovers, right? And the day after, on Tuesday or Wednesday, your voice is back to normal again. The issue is that if it doesn't recover, right? And then that's a sign really to what the listener, I think, was asking, was that's that injury.
Sure.
Right.
And, you know, Libby, I had a caller just text me, why is my voice better in the morning and worse in the evening?
So that's a really good question. So I don't know how old the age of the caller or the listener.
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Yeah, so oftentimes when we become a little bit more advanced in years, I always say a little bit more wisdom.
Sure.
That
got it.
The vocal folds change as we age, and that's a normal process of aging. It's not overuse or anything like that. It's just what happens. And oftentimes with those folks, they'll notice that their voice is pretty good in the morning, maybe once they kind of warm up, and then it kind of fizzles out by the end of the day and is inconsistent, and there's decreased projection and maybe raspiness and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That sometimes is part of it, is you're throughout the day you're talking, and if you're having to exert a little bit more effort than maybe everybody else, or maybe more than you used to, or maybe more than you should, your voice oftentimes fatigues by the end of the day. You've only got so much time to use it. So that's when, you know, you see your friendly ENT person, and they take a look down at your voice box, and they make sure nothing bad's going on. And they may have you do something called voice therapy to work on how you're using your anatomy to the best of your ability so that you have the best voice for the longest period throughout the day.
And are there exercises, to help or to rehabilitate?
So there are. There's lots of exercises, and unfortunately there isn't like one that I can tell everybody. So it's very individualized.
Specific.
To what people need. So, you know, one person's going to need something totally different than the other, even though maybe their voices sound sort of similar, right?
Sure.
They're all raspy, but maybe this person needs one thing and another person needs something totally different. And so, you know, that's where you need to work with, like, folks who have dedicated their lives to helping people rehabilitate their voices.
And, you know, I have another question coming through here, Libby, and this person is saying that they've been to their ENT doctor for hoarseness, he is telling them that their vocal cords are sagging. Can you run across that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm not exactly sure, but I'm guessing that that person may have atrophy, maybe if they're a little bit more advanced in years and wisdom.
Okay.
And what we see with atrophy, vocal fold atrophy, is that a couple things happen. One, those folks usually complain of raspiness, inconsistency, not sure what's going to come out when they start talking, maybe increased effort to talk, decreased projection,
yep.
and then vocal fatigue. Those are probably the main ones. And what we see is that as we age, normal process, our vocal folds change. No different than, you know, it's harder to open a jar when you're 70 than when you're 20, right? Your muscles aren't as strong. And the muscle, the main muscle of the voice box does change, but the, also the cover over it that leads to that vibration also changes. And so those there's vocal fold changes, and then there's also respiratory changes. So the way we make sound is we have to think of the thought. We have to fill our lungs with air, and then we use that air to power the voice. Okay. So if you have lung issues, and we know that as we age, our ribs don't have the same compliance that they did previously, you get a little oomph when you're doing it, that in and of itself can affect the voice, even if the vocal folds are perfect, right? So in atrophy, we call it vocal fold atrophy or presbyphonia. Elderly voice issues that we have to think about all of that. We have to think about the lungs, and we have to think about the voice box and make sure that everything's coordinated and optimized. And oftentimes voice therapy is very, very helpful. And in very few cases do we actually need to do surgery. And that surgery is sometimes helpful and sometimes not. So we don't jump there. We always do non-surgical stuff first. But oftentimes voice therapy is really helpful to engage those lungs and power the system so that you can make good voice with those skinny, floppy vocal folds that happen when we get older.
Well, you know, I think what that tells us here, these vocal cords play a very important role in our lives. You know, with our speaking, but also there's all these other ancillary systems that are necessary to help make us speak well and clearly and not have fatigue, correct?
Absolutely. And I always think of, you know, we have people come in and they'll be like, oh, I'm just sad because I can't read the stories to my grandchildren. It's not a big deal, but it makes me sad. I said, well, that's horrible because that's what brings you joy. So even though it's, thank goodness it's not cancer, hopefully, right, that it's equally important for you to have quality of life. And voice is something we take for granted until we don't have it. And once we don't have it, it's really hard. You don't realize how often we interact with others. And if people have a lot of voice issues, sometimes they'll isolate. And then they're not interacting with their family and their community. It's also hard to advocate for yourself. You know, let's say you're going to a doctor's appointment and you're having a hard time articulating, being heard, what's going on, right? And so having that ability to advocate for yourself and interact with your surroundings in the way you want to is super important. And so that's why, like, where we are here, we have a voice center dedicated solely to that because it's that important.
Yeah.
And so fortunately, there's multiple voice centers across the country now, but it's there's more as time moves on. When I first started doing this, like I said, 18 and a half years ago, there were very few, and now there's more, which is great because that means that more people can be helped. So it's wonderful.
I love the philosophy. And, you know, I think made some very important points, you know, with regard to phonating and being able to speak and advocating for yourself. And when you can't do that, there's some isolation, very similar to our patients that can't hear. And they have difficulties not hearing their loved ones. So they tend to get isolated as well and tend to get away from communicating, correct?
Absolutely, and it makes me think of sometimes the person with the hearing loss isn't the person with the voice issue, so maybe it's their partner. So now you've got someone who has a low-volume voice talking to someone who has a hearing issue, and it makes that communication exceptionally challenging. And sometimes people just say, forget it. I'm not going to do it. And and then you get the isolation and maybe depression associated with it. So it's amazing how much impact something that we take for granted, like voice, can have an impact on the whole body, like whole mental psyche and everything. Yeah.
And lifestyle and depression and enjoying our older years.
Right, right. Got to enjoy
beautiful.
It.
Yes, absolutely, and maintain it. You know, I have another issue here that came through. A listener just emailed me, what's a vocal cord paralysis? What happens with that, Libby?
So a vocal cord paralysis, remember we talked at the beginning that there's two vocal cords. There's a right one and a left one. And I may say cords and folds, they mean the same thing. So a vocal cord paralysis. So it basically means that the vocal cord doesn't move, and it can land, basically live, anywhere along the spectrum of what its original movement was. Typically, it's closer to the middle, maybe not right at the middle, because those people sound great. They don't know they have a problem, frankly. But if usually it's a little bit off to the side, and those people are just really raspy, and then other people, it's really way out to the side. I would say like out in left field, out in right field.
Yes.
And those people are super breathy. You can barely hear them.
So they're not able to articulate well.
Yeah, they just don't have any. They're so far apart that they can't get any vibration and any sound going. So paralysis, by definition, means that it's due to the nerve that goes to the muscles. So that nerve and those muscles aren't communicating well anymore. And so that can happen from lots of different reasons. So probably the most common is from a surgery where the nerve is either stretched or heated up too much with the instrumentation that we use during surgery or cut. And if there's that lack of electrical circuit going through the nerve and going to the muscle, then the muscle's like, oh, I guess I don't need to do anything. I'm not getting any input from the nerve. So it just sits there. And so we do one of my big things is something called laryngeal EMG, electromyography, and that's looking at how the nerve and the muscle are talking to each other. And with that, we can give prognosis. Does it seem like your vocal fold might perk back up or not, and then that helps us drive treatment. Not everyone does that, but it's usually from a nerve issue. It can also be from, like, surgery. Sorry, it could be from a surgical injury. The other thing is it can be from the breathing tube during a surgery. It can also be from having a cold. The nerve is that does this is called the recurrent laryngeal nerve, and it's kind of a wussy nerve. It is pretty sensitive to viruses, apparently, because it's not uncommon to have people say, I had a cold, my voice was bad, it never got better, I look, and their vocal cord isn't moving. It doesn't happen all the time, but I'm not surprised when I hear it, because it's happened enough. So it could be from that. And then sometimes, frankly, we never find out why it happened. It just did, and we don't know why. Back in the day, before vaccines and antibiotics, you know, a lot of the things we get vaccines for now actually caused vocal fold paralysis and really, really bad infections of the voice box that would then paralyze the nerve. So we don't see that anymore because people are vaccinated, fortunately, and that's a good thing. So, it can be from a myriad of different things, but the number one cause is usually, at least in like the United States, is from surgery. Because the nerve travels all the way through the chest. It's got a really long course. So anything along that course can hit it.
Can damage it. And you know, you mentioned, Libby, EMG.
Yeah.
How do you do an EMG of the recurrent laryngeal nerve and the muscles of the voice box? Is that done with the patient asleep? What is the process?
Yeah, so they're actually awake for it because they have to participate. So I need to actually have them say E and sniff during the exam, and you have to be awake to do that. So they are awake. So I do it in conjunction with a person called an electromyographer. And so they have specialized training in working the EMG machine. It's basically a couple of electrodes. And there's a little needle electrode, and after numbing up the skin over kind of right below where the vocal cords are housed, there's a little space there. And I go in through there, and your vocal folds are sitting right underneath that. And so after numbing them up, I'll put this little needle in and have them say E and sniff and do all those tasks. And then we can basically record and evaluate, measure how the nerve and the muscle are communicating to each other. And from that, we get a lot of really valuable, I find, information that I then can help counsel the patient and create a very specific plan for them. Now, not many places do laryngeal EMG. I don't do it for all of my patients or even most of them, but because of what I do, people are sent here from all over, that I get the toughest of the tough usually. And so, you know, having that extra information is oftentimes really helpful to better understand. It's a diagnostic test, better understand what's going on. It takes about 15 minutes to do. Yeah.
Thank you. Libby, you know, we're out of time. Mr. Mancini's flagging me here. That our hour is almost right at the end. And Mr. Mancini, are you there?
Let me take one more real quick with about 4 minutes and change, and then we could do a recap and share the info with everybody and how to get a hold of you guys. Steve from Corvallis, Oregon, listens to the show all the time. He says, what is a weak voice a sign of? If we can elaborate that in a minute or less.
Yeah, so a weak voice can – yeah, it's usually either weak pulmonary drive or weak closure of the vocal folds, which can be atrophy, paralysis, glottic incompetence, something like that. So it's usually either one of those or maybe even both.
So the instrument isn't top-notch. The instrument's wearing out a little bit, Libby. Is that it?
Yeah, you got a leak somewhere in the system. Either you're not giving enough power or the vocal folds themselves aren't coming together well enough to create that good sound, and therefore the voice gets weak.
There you go. Go ahead, Mr. Mancini. What else do you have?
Well, with about 3 minutes exactly, recap real fast, and then we'll share information and preview next week.
Libby, do you want to give us a real quick recap of hoarseness and the vocal fold function?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to always remember that voice is important, and I love it as a sign of, like, everyone needs to have a voice, but also, like, be able to talk, but also they need to have their own personal voice, their own advocacy, and you need to have a voice to have a voice.
Sure.
So if you have hoarseness, I think probably the most important thing is, if you have hoarseness for over 2 to 4 weeks and you're over the age of 40, and you're a smoker, you definitely need to get checked out, because we have to rule out that there isn't a bad thing like cancer going on. If you're younger than 40 and you're hoarse for 4 weeks, I'd probably get checked out too, because there's probably something that can be done to help you, because being hoarse is really hard. It's hard to live the life you want to live and the quality of life.
So hoarseness is a symptom. Our listeners should get to their healthcare professional. I think that would be the word of the night.
Yep.
And Libby, how do people get a hold of you?
So I'm at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And so looking up on the internet is probably the easiest way for the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And there's actually three of us here who do this work, as well as our speech language pathologists. It's probably the best way. But also there's probably great people, especially, you know, if someone's coming from Corvallis, right? You don't need to come from Oregon all the way out to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
You know, they have great centers. Usually they're associated with the universities, so that's a good place to start.
Excellent.
Wow.
And
Doc, how can they get a hold of you?
Yes, sir. It's GJRMD308@outlook.com. You know, things have been going well. Next week, we have a psychologist, Deborah Gilman, who's been on the show before, talking about relationships, and how relationships are changing today with the many crises in the world. And, you know, there's a lot going on that's very upsetting to an awful lot of people, affecting relationships. So she has some real good points of view. She just wrote a new book. She'll be talking about that. She's been on the show before, so it should be a very interesting show. So thank you, Mr. Mancini.
Well, thank you very much. As we wrap this thing up, you can catch the archive version on blogtalkradio.com/ Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms, or if you subscribe to Podcast Power Now by Mancini Media. For Dr. Libby Smith in Pittsburgh, Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, yours truly, Mark Mancini, saying thank you very much for making us each and every week stronger. Tell all your friends. We'll talk to you next week with Dr. Deborah Gilman, the psychologist. Till then, have a blessed and safe weekend. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good night. Thank you.